path for decades of championing democracy and human rights as an institution. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've wrote a book in Russia about oligarchs. I understand how difficult it is when you have a lively and independent group of journalists, and ownership really matters. And, you know, we're not just another widget company. This is actually a group of very, very deep thinking and oftentimes very aggressive people that have a desire to change the world. That's the kind of journalism that the Washington Post has sponsored and engaged in. In 2023, we published a series of editorials that took a look deep inside how China, Russia, Burma, you know, other places, how these autocracies function. One of the findings was that many of these dictatorships are using technology to clamp down on dissent, even things as tiny as a single tweet. Young people, young college students are being thrown in prison in Cuba, in Belarus, in Vietnam, and I documented these to show how this technology actually isn't becoming a force for freedom, but it's being turned on its head by dictatorship.
We have to leave it there. David Hoffman, Washington Post reporter, stepped down from the Post editorial board when they refused to endorse presidential candidate Mariel Garza, LA Times editorials editor who just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
This morning, we will not be airing Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy. They'll be back next week. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland.
Ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before talking about a subject.
As voters enter an election, many feel that democracy itself is in jeopardy. And you have to bring the center for justice involved.
Sounded so bad.
1906. And one was supported by the Atlanta Journal, one was supported by the Atlanta Constitution. Those were the two major newspapers in Atlanta. And the two papers today are combined, the Atlanta Journal Constitution is called. And they use the two papers to promote their political platforms, and they argued both that they were a bigger racist than the other guy, or a bigger white supremacist than the other guy. And they were like, and back then they didn't have to use dog whistle politics. They could just be open. They're like, I hate N-words. I want white supremacy. And they were very clear about it. So you can read the papers and they just are like, how can we disenfranchise the Negro? And so each man claimed that he was more effective in eliminating the black vote than the other guy. And so they had to come up with a platform to, and they were running for the Democratic primary in the state. And so they were like, there were other guys in the race, but these were the two major ones. And so they said, hey, one guy said, I will eliminate the black vote by creating a constitutional amendment, eliminating their vote altogether. And another guy said, well, you know, I will do it by having literacy tests. And the other dude said, well, if we have the literacy test, we will eliminate a whole bunch of white people the way it happened in Virginia. And literally saying, one guy at least was saying that this literacy test will support black people and undermine whites. Ultimately, they had to pander to ignorance and fear of the white voters. And they had to convince through ignorance and fear white voters that black people were a fundamental threat to democracy and to white supremacy in Georgia. So one argument was that they were idle, shiftless, lazy, and childlike and cannot make wise political choices, and therefore were a threat that could be easily bought and corrupted, and therefore should be eliminated from the political process. Another argument, and this is confounding to perhaps a lot of listeners here. Another argument, and they vacillated, two candidates vacillated between these two positions here. Another argument was that black people were too aspirational, too industrious, too politically cunning, and that their ambition will undermine the racial order, and then black people will be put on top.
Hoke Smith, the former publisher of the Atlanta Journal, and Clark Howe, the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, were exploiting their news platforms to promote themselves while running for governor. Both newspapers sparked anger and hatred among its white readers, with stories playing to their fears. These sensationalist stories created such a tense environment that by late September, citywide violence erupted in the streets, with white mobs vandalizing black-owned businesses, assaulting hundreds, and killing 25 African Americans during the 4 days of racial violence. This day in Georgia's history would later come to be known as the Atlanta Race Massacre, seen as a direct result of the election.
In September of 1906, we had a series of reports in the white press that black people had been attacking white women and girls. Whites poured out into the streets and started murdering black people. And you had and many people ask, like, why didn't Atlanta have a Tulsa? But Atlanta did, and that was Atlanta's Tulsa. So 1906 race massacre happened in September in 1906, and mobs of hordes of thugs and hoodlums poured out into the street, attacking people, pulling people from streetcars, burning black businesses. Hoodlums went into people's homes, kicked in doors. Black people were hanged from lampposts. Businesses were burned and destroyed. And the city ended up being in a civil collapse for about 2 or 3 days. The state militia had to come in and restore sort of order, if you will. But in the process, they brutalized black people as well. It was an all-white state militia, and they sided with the thugs and barbarians who were running through the street, destroying and causing chaos and violence. So it was a very harrowing 3 days, and it went down as a turning point in black Atlanta and white Atlanta in many ways, too. There were whites in the city who came out and tried to protect their black friends, and there are cases of white bravery. What's also surprising to a lot of people is that you have cases of the most elite, aristocratic black people that you've ever seen. Like, you see those old 19th century photos or early 20th century Victorian old elite black folks. Those people, W.E.B. Du Bois, Walter White, who became called Mr. NAACP, the first black president of Morehouse College, John Hope, his wife, Lugina Burns Hope, They actually had guns. They passed guns out to black people. And many of us see this famous picture of Malcolm X with a gun peering through his assault rifle peering through a window. But Du Bois, who was ironically or coincidentally at the same age as Malcolm in that photo, about 38 years old, Du Bois had his own, he had a double barrel Winchester shotgun on my porch with shells waiting to blow the guts of a terrorist on my front lawn if they came to murder my family.
Status, education, and prominence did not shield W.E.B. Du Bois from the risk of violence. As segregation tightened its grip across the nation, many African Americans developed an understanding and practice of armed self-resistance in an attempt to protect themselves from white Southern authorities and terrorist organizations.
The New York Times reported how shocked they were to see so many armed African Americans, and that the image of black people, the only images that white Americans had of black people, were servile, cowardly, minstrel coons. That's all the images they had. They had nothing other than that in the dominant expression of blackness in pop culture in the United States. Yet, in 1906, the New York Times reported that 300 black men were marched off and stripped of their guns, and that black men had been defending themselves, and according to New York Times, they took it a solid way. And they joked at the fear of the whites because they had armed themselves and defended their community the way they did. And they were marched with state militia, 300 men, gunpoint with machine guns at them. They marched them, arrested them, and took them downtown because they were defending themselves against terrorists. But this was a really powerful scene. In many ways, it's been overlooked in the national discourse. I mean, I've never met anybody in Atlanta who does not know about the Atlanta Race Massacre of 1906. I'm sure there are people there who don't know about it, but it's not something that's a secret in Atlanta. But on a national scale, very few people are aware of it.
What two political figures in the 21st century that would best represent a similar dog whistle mindset of Howland Smith? You know, because I think it's important to connect the dots for folks. Clark and Hoke were very polarizing figures, but we still have that even now in today's time.
If you look at modern iterations of this effort to appeal to the most base elements of humanity, right? Ignorance and fear, and people who traffic in ignorance and fear in order to win election. Not sort of aspirational, not hopeful, not saying what I can do for you, but what I can do to eliminate them, or you know, destabilize them, or neutralize the threat of them. And I think that in terms of the national election, Trump is the closest who comes to mind. You know, he came out in 2016 by saying that, you know, Mexico is sending, you know, rapists and drug dealers, and they're worse.
When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me. But they're killing us economically. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. Thank you. It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting. And it only makes common sense. They're sending us not the right people. It's coming from more than Mexico. It's coming from all over South and Latin America, and it's got to stop. And it's got to stop fast.
So there's a threat of them, you know. And then you have him referring to immigrants from these other countries. And he had a speech where he talked about they're polluting our blood, right? And that these people, and he named people from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, right? He named these continents, and he made a point not to name Europe. And so he's very clear with dog whistle politics in the same sort of way that we might see Clark Howell and Hoke Smith in 1906. And this is very unfortunate. And I think that the base, you have people who are, again, hostile to fairness and democracy. And I'm not sure how curious they are about a world beyond their narrow, myopic points of information.
Clark Howell and Hoke Smith can be considered the early pioneers of racist dog whistle politics
known for invoking racial appeals to persuade white voters to support policies that may threaten their own interests and American democracy. It's a long political tradition of loaded rhetoric, be it promises to crack down on crime, restrict access to public aid programs, and the protection of American purity through the restriction of non-European immigrants. Simply put, the minority is the problem, which is problematic because it limits one's ability to critically see the commonality and struggle and the connections between the political agendas they support. But this too is an old narrative. I asked Professor Ogbar to share with me the story of Tom Watson. Watson, an early figure in American history who urged poor whites to not be fooled by plutocrats and politicians. Instead, he asked them to recognize the economic hardship and political marginalization shared by both blacks and whites.
There are a number of people that come up in the book, a lot of fascinating characters. And one person I was familiar with before I began the research was a white Georgian guy named Tom Watson. Tom Watson in the 19th century was a lawyer. His father served in the Confederacy and was killed. He was a successful guy who looked around Atlanta and looked around Georgia in the late 19th century and saw that poor people, whites and blacks, were being exploited by the same class of exploiters. And he said that, I'm paraphrasing him here, but he said that imagine an arch that supports your oppression and your poverty and your economic, social, political marginalization. He told poor people, white and black, the keystone to that arch is racism, right? And the term racism didn't exist, but he said racial hatred or something to that extent. So he said that racism supported your oppression, white guys, and that you may be barefoot, you could be broke down, you'd be illiterate, you might be unable to provide for your family, but you believe that some rich guy who is creating policies for other rich guys will benefit you because you see yourself in him, not the people who share your economic lot. And you could all benefit by having labor reform, by having child welfare reform, educational reform. And they talk about all these reforms and the taxes on these big corporations that are exploiting everyone. But at the end of the day, their fidelity to white nationalism won out. And so at the end of the day, they got nothing from it other than what Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, famous historian, said, the psychological wages of whiteness. So they might still go back to their little hovel, a little hut, a little shack, no health care, no education, but they psychologically feel themselves tethered to the elite whites and therefore have a psychological wage. That's what Du Bois talks about. So we do see definitely a theme of that running through politics presently.
Tom Watson's political thought is still being debated today. He's viewed as a complicated Georgia figure that cannot be put in a box. In the start of his career, he was labeled a liberal, especially for his time. But later in life, Watson stepped away from his liberal beliefs. By 1904, resentful of the manipulation of black voters by Southern whites, which resulted in many failed political campaigns for him, and with the growing influence of black leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois, Watson became a staunch supporter of white supremacy. Even though Tom Watson lived more than 100 years ago, Dr. Ogbar points out that in Georgia, white nationalism is still very much alive, but the strategies to impede the black vote have evolved with the times.
So I always think that at the end of the day, to your earlier question about what Atlanta demonstrates to the possibilities of the United States is the possibility of a huge turnout. And I will say this, Anita Johnson, and I will say this, right now, there are people working overtime under the cloak of being super woke black people. And they're like, okay, we need to convince black people not to turn out. So we can create voter suppression laws. We can criminalize giving an old woman water who's standing in line. But what we need to do is convince black people that their vote does not count. We need to get super woke black people or people who pretend to be super woke black people to go online and tell black folks that there's no difference between the parties and the best way to demonstrate their political power is not voting.
For decades, the black community has been a loyal voting bloc for Democrats. But with recent polls citing black voter disillusionment, some black folks are discussing abandoning the political process altogether in order to make a political statement that the black vote won't be taken for granted.
I think right now we're going to be confronted with a group of people who will continue to assault us with information about how we need to not vote. And the congressional bipartisan investigations on Russian meddling in the 2016 election found that Russians spent more money targeting one demographic group in the United States to suppress their vote, and that was African Americans, because African Americans were voted against Trump. And they did that. And people were like, well, and so I think this is a fact of matter, that voter suppression takes many forms. And one of the forms is to convince Black people that their vote, I always tell that their vote doesn't matter. I always tell people that if your votes didn't matter, then Fannie Lou Hamer wouldn't have been picked up and tortured and put in jail, right? If your votes didn't matter, they wouldn't have been blowing up people in churches, little Black kids in churches, hanging people from trees. If your votes didn't matter, they wouldn't have spent hundreds of millions of man hours over the course of, you know, 400 years to prevent your ancestors from voting, right? Voting clearly matters. They want you to think so, and this is their latest ruse.
What do you see as the three biggest threats moving into the 2024 election?
Well, I do think that you have belligerent, ignorant, hateful rhetoric coming out of the Trump camp. I've not seen in any way people who have, and I've been around, and I'm a historian, I've not known people who've stormed buildings, and let alone the federal capital, and trying to undermine the election and create a coup. And of course they will say that Trump won, but members of their own party are quick to say all across the United States, from Georgia to Michigan and Arizona, elected Republicans themselves said that the election was fair. There was no widespread voter fraud, and Trump lost. And Trump's advisors said that he lost. They told him that he lost. Bill Barr, his attorney general, told him he lost. And Bill Barr left rather than be part of this whole thing. And there are people who ideologically I find repugnant, but they understand the utility of the law and elections. And as much as I might have found someone like George Herbert Walker Bush anathema to my beliefs, when he lost the election, he didn't go out like Trump. He didn't go out like Bashar al-Assad in Syria, or Mubarak in Egypt, or Mugabe, or Papa Doc, or Marcos, or Pinochet. I could go, or Tito, right? I could go through a whole list of or Hitler or Stalin or somebody, right? I go to the whole list of people who have dismissed the democratic process because they wanted to stay in power, and they will run the country in the ground otherwise. Trump is not cut from the same cloth as typical politicians. Trump is, again, like Bashar al-Assad of Syria, is like, I will tear this MF down if I don't stay in power. And that's a fundamental danger. That's different than what we've dealt with before, you know? And that, I think, is a fundamental threat to the American Republic in a way that even Republicans who are not running for re-election, all of them, almost all of them, are like, Trump is an existential danger to the American Republic. And that's the thing that I try to explain to people, why, you know, people are like, there's no difference. I mean, obviously, the Supreme Court demonstrates more starkly than anything else in the last few years what a difference is between these parties. But also, we have to disrupt this idea that we only vote for an ideologically pure position, that somehow, if you are not ideologically pure, I will not support you. And that's a guaranteed way to lose an election every single time, if you ever take that position. And as much as I would love someone to be more progressive or more radical or more this, more that, at the end of the day, I know there are two options, and one person will give much more to my community than the other, or a little bit more than the community, or do less damage than the other. And I don't take loss of life lightly, right? So if it comes down to it, I will vote for the one that will benefit my community more than the other. Is a very clear issue for me. And I don't understand this position of trying to say that white supremacists were right, Black people should not vote. I will not side with white supremacists who said that Black people should just stay at home and not vote. But there's some people who want to do that. That's on them.
Playing devil's advocate and not letting what you just said go over people's heads. I've heard this before. Some people say it's a conspiracy theory. People are crying wolf. But you're suggesting, if I understand correctly, that our democracy is in jeopardy because we're dealing with someone, meaning Trump, who could exist in a space like other dictators that have just decided to sit in the seat, that he would be, if given the opportunity, he would put into place ways that he could not be removed, or he would create an atmosphere that might create what we saw when he was ousted or forced to leave presidential office.
So let's look at the world right now. We have two world leaders, Putin and Xi Jinping, both in while they were president in China and Russia have modified their constitution so they can stay in office longer. That's now. I don't know if people thought, oh, Putin can do this, that's impossible. Xi Jinping can do this, that's impossible. I don't know if they were having those conversations those other places. But in our lifetime, right now, that's happened. I don't see how the United States would be different. I'm sure there are people in 1860 when Lincoln got elected, like, oh no, Civil War can't happen. No, that's not, this is the United States. And of course, more Americans got killed in that conflict than wars combined, right? 700,000 Americans dead 4 years later. I think that a lot of times people think of themselves as somehow special and not prone to the predilections of other places that are not somehow as evolved. But time and again, we found ourselves in positions where we have been surprised by our capacity to go off path. And I don't think that many people have thought that you have had a president who will refuse to recognize that he lost, even when his closest advisors told him he lost, and even when his own vice president told him he lost, and even when his attorney general told him he lost. And I don't think that we have thought that we have seen a president who will then inspire a mob of thugs to run up into the Capitol. And literally, these people are chanting, hang Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, because he didn't try to support a coup. And that even when people were calling the president of the United States, telling him to nationalize troops and send them out to protect these lawmakers, that he refused to for hours, right? I don't know if people would have thought that 3 years earlier. And even now, half of Americans, if not slightly more, are willing to put that same man back in power. And it shows you the degree to which there are certain people who find democracy inconvenient when its results are not what they wanted it to be. And this is very frightening to me, you know? I mean, because anything can happen, right? And that this is very frightening. And I think that there's no way to ignore the fact that Trump is this fundamental threat. And, you know, people can say what they want to say about, you know, Biden. And the thing is, I find crazy that people like John Bolton, you know, these people who are hardcore right-wing Republicans who are explaining how much of a fundamental threat Trump is. I mean, you don't have anything like this in the Democratic Party. As much as people might not be super enthusiastic about Biden, at the end of the day, he's not a fundamental threat to America. A very different landscape. You do not have people who work closely with Biden who are coming out saying that this man is a fundamental threat to America. You have that with Trump in spades.
Whether you agree with Dr. Ogbar or not, one thing is clear. The stakes are high this election year. I'm Anita Johnson, and this is Making Contact. I spoke with the University of Connecticut historian Jeffrey O.G. Ogbar, Ph.D., about his book, America's Black Capital, How African Americans Remade Atlanta in the Shadow of the Confederacy.
Had to wonder if this day would ever come. For he faced not only the enmity of governments, including, of course, the U.S. government, but of much of the media, for he scooped most of them with ease. His work there unveiled the true face of imperial war, especially regarding the Iraq War, where Americans killed civilians with impunity. That made him an enemy of the state, but it didn't unmake him as a journalist. In fact, many of the same media that attacked him saw no problem with using his scoops and reports. He spent years in detention in a foreign embassy and later in British custody. Most of his staunchest supporters never wavered. And finally, he made his way home. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. In the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa.
Picasso,
what?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Dollar is what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas to PNN, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host, Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia. In studio with Pablo Scala Popoy, mi carnal Tiny, and you, Pablo Scala, Tiburcio Garcia.
Yeah, this is PNN, not CNN, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio, broadcast live and direct from the small part of unpimped, unplayed, unbought, unsold Mama Earth that us houseless people call homefulness, lifting up the beautiful spirit that is Wounded Knee de El Campo, a powerful Miwok elder who went on his spirit journey. Gregorian calendar date Monday, October 7th, which of course is also the day we mourned, we cried, we screamed for the babies, the mamas, the papas we lost to the colonial genocide terrorizing our relatives in Palestine and right here on Turtle Island. Uncle Wounded Knee was a powerful indigenous leader and elder who prayed with the longest walks across Turtle Island, as well as for the liberation of this stolen land, Miwok and Ohlone, Lashon, and all native land the colonizers called California United Snakes. We lift up your great spirit and resistance. We were blessed to walk with you, to pray with you, to stand with you, and to love and care for Mama Earth with you.
We are peaceful people. Don't turn violence on us. Don't come over here with your billy club to beat us. This is what your ancestors did to our people.
The staff lifted, graced with feathers from sacred birds gifted. The staff flew up to be with the clouds. The prayer smoke knew it was Uncle Wounded looking down. His voice was soft. Then it was loud. We are peaceful people. Because his prayer would always calm the crowd. The wind blew through every word. His heart had wings from all the sacred birds. The mama trees whispered, "Thank you." The four-leggeds and the winged ones spoke, and you knew. Uncle Wounded Knee, every prayer from your lips carried me into another place of gentle grace, of liberated space, away from deadly colonizers' gaze, from the shell mound of Segorite, from 5,000 Gregorian years to yesterday. You walked and walked and walked for a liberated day. We will miss you and mourn you every single day. Thank you, Wounded Knee, De Ocampo, for the great love you carried from Mama Ocean to the sacred mountains. Deep bow, Uncle Wounded, for your beautiful life as you now take the greatest walk of all time. But please, please, Uncle, stay close, because not a ceremony, an action, or a prayer will go by without your powerful voice, without your spirit, your medicine, right by our side.
Up next, 1 year after the most recent genocide of our relatives in Gaza, we hear voices of resistance.
We are here today to honor 1 year of genocide, to honor our martyrs, and to honor 1 year of resistance. We are here because we know that though their bodies fall, their ideas do not. And for every martyr that falls, another will rise, and our struggle will continue. Today, we stand in protest with millions across the world who have stood up and took to the streets. Today, we are here on this International Day of Action to send a clear message that our people will never submit to the tyranny of Zionism. From Palestine to Lebanon to Yemen to right here in the diaspora, we will rise in defiance of colonial violence. We march to mark 1 year since the brave people of Gaza refused to die quietly in the face of a 17-year-long brutal siege. We march today to mark 1 year since 2.2 million people trapped within the largest open-air prison on the planet showed the world that they will never give up the struggle for liberation. We march today for our heroes in Lebanon, who have shown us time and time again the true weakness of the Zionist entity. We march today for our heroes in Yemen, who have shown the entire world what solidarity really means. And you all are here today, and we are all here today, because even after a year of our people facing the most brutal genocide of our generation, a genocide that is meant to keep us fragmented, a genocide that is meant to destroy our hope, a genocide that is meant to silence us, that is meant to break us, we are still here because you all and we all refuse to break.
You just heard one of the many voices of resistance from 1 year anniversary of genocide and resistance action in Occupy El Amo. Up next, we speak to folks curating a powerful art show with art from relatives behind the razor wire plantation walls.
We know that there are many ways that we resist this ongoing colonial genocide right here in Turtle Island, right here on this occupied land, while we lift up so many acts of removal and displacement and incarceration all across Mama Earth. But we know that right here, there's that other kind of colonization, which is the plantation that essentially incarcerates every poor person it gets. Many folks behind these razor wire plantations have their own words, their own art forms. They are resistors in their own right. We are blessed to have some folks who are helping to curate a powerful art show that's going to be visiting us right here in the Bay Area to lift up the art from behind those prison walls. Welcome, Ileana, to Poor People's Radio.
Thanks for listening.
Tell listeners a little bit about what your organization does.
My name's Ileana. I'm one of the student organizers, and we've been putting together a beautiful art show. We've worked for over a year now, coordinating with people in San Quentin and Chowchilla Prison, asking them to send us over their art in efforts to raise money for them. This event is going to be October 19th at La Peña Cultural Center from 5:30 to 9. We're centering this event from, like I said, art sent in from our incarcerated communities. And we're also planning on having some community orgs at the event to show support and spread the love. All the proceeds from the event are going to go directly back to the artists. Every single cent made goes back to them, to the individual or to their families, whatever they chose. This is going to be a great event, and we hope to see everyone there.
Are you able to speak about some of the artists who are submitting work?
We have two curators that we've been in communication with, and they basically talk to their people. They were looking for their artists. A lot of the statements and art that we got center their communities, what they think trying to find freedom within an incarcerated space, a hostile environment is. And a lot of that comes from their communities, the people that they miss, the places that they haven't been able to see and the places that they wish to see. That's kind of where this art is coming from. And it's a deeply beautiful thing to see as we see these packages come in and we're putting them up in this community center, reminding ourselves of the people that have been hidden from our communities on purpose.
Are they mixed media?
We have mostly on canvas and paper. We have a couple comic pieces, really cool art, different styles. The ones I'm most excited to see are the comic pieces. Some of it viewing the continuing genocide in Palestine from the perspective of being behind walls in prison and trying to figure that out from a place that doesn't want you to see what's going on in the world. And we also plan on having live art and spoken word. We want to hear from the community, too, while they view the art.
So you're going to be having some folks speaking as well?
Yes, we will.
I wanted to lift up that we just ended a trial, which, you know, many feel was a Mickey Mouse trial of retaliation against the prison hunger strikers and the violence of living in so-called solitary confinement, the SHU, all of these spaces and places that are there to destroy human beings, and how really in so many ways the art was a lot of times the only thing that kept a lot of these relatives alive, that art is resistance, and that, you know, recognizing that just because folks are in these institutions that are there to destroy them, it doesn't mean that they don't have beautiful art. Lifting up Jose Villarreal and Minister King and some of our other Poor Magazine Familia who are artists and have been artists for their whole life, whether or not they're in a plantation prison system or not. Just really honored and excited that you guys are doing this and thankful that you're doing it. Is there any last words you'd like to say and just give folks another plug of where and when they can go?
You can keep following us on social media, Instagram, Teach in Prison, UCB. If you want to learn more about the event, all of our tickets are there. All the info is there. So we hope to see y'all come support and see some cool art made on the inside and to celebrate these people's accomplishments in making art in a hostile space. This event is going to be October 19th at La Peña Cultural Center, 3105 Shattuck Avenue. And the event will be open from 5:30 to 9 p.m.
Thank you so much, family. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. What's your name and what are we doing today?
My name is Minister King X of California Prison Focus, CAS Universal. So I'm here with attorney Richard Tan and my other attorney, Eric, and Kelly, she's in the back. So we're here today because there's a lawsuit against CDCR for Penal Code 4571 and some of the discriminatory statements that they made inside of our police report stipulated that I, along with others alike, accentuated our black identity extremists. So we're here because people being criminalized without fair and constructive notice.
Tell us about what 4571 is.
Penal Code 4571 says that if you had a felony conviction in the past and you were on the grounds of or lands adjacent to a prison or a jail, then you've committed a felony, unless you get the permission of the warden of the facility. Now, the part lands adjacent thereto is very potentially flexible, let's put it that way. So one of the problems with the statute is that if you're standing on a public sidewalk, as King was doing when he was demonstrating for Rochelle's freedom, you could potentially be liable for violating Penal Code 4571. The other problem is that CDCR applies the statute in a discriminatory and retaliatory way. There are people who are on the grounds of a prison who have had convictions who are not prosecuted for 4571, but somehow when King was demonstrating for the longest held political prisoner in California, then CDCR and the Investigative Services Unit discovered that he was violating Penal Code section and then found a reason to grab him.
Yeah, you mentioned the building we're standing in front of, and now there's desks and offices and what I would call paper knives.
This is the headquarters of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. This is where the executive level decisions and administrative work is done on a statewide level. But of course, the real impact of the decisions made here are felt in the prisons throughout the state and in the lives of people who have been subjected to mass incarceration. And those effects continue after release, and this law 4571, which we've challenged as unconstitutional, is a very stark example of that, because it runs against the principles that this country, however hypocritically, professes to believe in, such as freedom of speech and assembly guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution. Because what 4571 says, as Richard mentioned a moment ago, is that even if you're just adjacent to a jail or a prison and you've been formally incarcerated in a state prison, that will mean that you're guilty of a felony offense unless you get the permission from the warden or sheriff who runs that facility. That is also what's known as a prior restraint, which means you have to ask permission to be able to speak, to gather with others, to express your views, to have a conversation on the street with someone, just to be present in public space, which is supposed to be a democratic right. And so we think that law can't stand, and so we've challenged it in federal court. And right now there's a motion from the defendants to have that suit dismissed. There's a court hearing in the Eastern District Federal Court, several blocks from here, and we'll see how that process turns out. Hopefully this case will be going forward and we can get some justice for Minister King and for everyone who's affected by this issue.
Minister King, the hypocrisy that I see here is you, from the gate, from the minute that the plantation system you left from nailed you, if you will, with all this BS, how would this 4571 stop you from doing the work that you do?
Starting inside, we were subjected to decades of solitary confinement through sensory deprivation. And when you come out here into society, you lose the right to vote, and we had to fight for those rights. And every day we strive and we struggle to fight. But when I think about having the opportunity to have an impeccable team of litigants by my side to help us narrate this story that we're subjected to corporate malfeasance on the inside and out. Without Kelly, without Richard, without Eric, I would still be incarcerated. That's something that I really want to highlight. So when All of Us or None came to our aid, when I was in front of California Prison Focus, Dorsey Nunn came outside and he seen these officers who had me kidnapped inside of an unmarked car. And he asked him, well, why is he in cuffs when this guy promotes the agreement to end hostilities? He's not promoting violence. He's not engaged in any underground criminal activity. And they said, because I violated my parole. Well, if I violated my parole, I should have went back inside. But it was because of the litigation of the facts that came about that I was held captive without a trial. So this is why we're here, because Penal Code 4571 violate your due process in every aspect without fair and constructive notice.
That's what I'm going to turn over to Kelly. So, you know, I don't have much belief in the Constitution. But wouldn't this be unconstitutional?
Oh, without a doubt, it's a violation of both First and 14th Amendment rights, the ability to demonstrate freely, but also the ability to know what is and what is not legal. We need to know what is adjacent to. That is not a term that has parameters around it. So the inability to know where you can be at any given time and to make it a felony to be on that location is, yes, most definitely a violation of one's.
And whoever wants to answer this, implications on the rest of us protesting. Anyone want to answer that? Well, maybe go ahead, Kelly.
Very similar to what I just said, that it has huge implications for anybody that's previously been incarcerated. They are at risk of a felony.
I would go so far to say, though, if they get away with this 4571 mess, what's the hop, skip, and a jump to all protesting?
Yes, that's a valid point.
So-called freedom of speech? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Any last words from anyone before we close out? I just want to say I appreciate you.
Yeah, just, you know, the, one of the things this lawsuit is about is vindicating the rights of all people who have a record in California. That's what Minister King is out here fighting for, and that's what we're trying to, like, vindicate in this lawsuit.
How can they support you, King?
Follow me on Instagram, official Minister King X. You also can follow our case on
www.prisonerswithchildren.org. One word.
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your?
That's all for this broadcast of Poor People's Radio. You can follow us on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Poor Magazine, at Poverty Scholar. You can also get this complete Poor People's Radio podcast with all the interviews and conversations on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or whatever you get your podcast from. All power to the people.
Talk, don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Needin' Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel grave beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I need with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. You go. It ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. We have all borne witness to the devastating weather and water events worldwide over the past few months. We've experienced massive rainstorms and record flood and erosion, roads uplifted and blocked by landslides, with high winds at the highest tides causing havoc in ports and working waterfronts, washing away beaches and coastal buildings, interrupting trade and traffic, harvesting and healing, all dependent on our interrelationship with the ocean and waterways as productive, protected place for commerce and community. It will take weeks, if not years, to restore structures and facilities, homes and businesses that are predicated on access to the coast for residents, work, and recreation. There is paradox and such terrible irony here. The combination of natural and social circumstance should come as no surprise. The coincidence of extreme weather, ocean temperature, high tide, high wind and surge, predictable and inevitable and forewarned. What was the preoccupation of scientists and environmentalists has now come home to all of us. Now, as we face property loss, insurance or the lack thereof, reconstructed material and labor costs, road and culvert replacement, and the additional loss by power outages and impassable roads and bridges, we face today and tomorrow, how it pains me to say it, the real price of our indifference and denial of yesterday. We are not alone, even as our loss is so close and personal. People all over the world are experiencing comparable event and consequence. For years, this sadness has been foreseen, alarms sounded, and during that same interval, we have denied and postponed and defeated and unfunded the steps that might have been taken to preclude or at least prepare to meet the inevitable, with adaptation, mitigation, and other inventive response to prevent the predictable, to protect us not just from physical damage, but also to psychological damage as real as the twisted piers, buildings, and interrupted normality of our daily lives. We will rebuild. We will demonstrate resilience and determination, and our communities will revive and take shape again. But will we respond with a plan that will protect our future, work, and living, and also address the deeper cause of the problem, the full challenge we must accept to solve it? That question is complicated and must be met with equally complicated response. We must admit to mistakes made and policies inadequate, to assumptions and attitudes that have not served us well. We must welcome new realities, take initiative, accept change, build a future that works, create a context for survival at all levels and in many forms. If you witnessed any of this destruction directly, if you saw it on the news, you cannot ignore the dramatic volume of it all, the waves enveloping coastal houses, mountainsides collapsing from erosion and runoff, highways destroyed, and access to homes isolated, community services rendered useless. The problem will not be solved by political declaration and emergency funding. It is time to make the connection that this will be an ongoing phenomenon, and we will have to respond to a degree and by actions never taken before. We cannot perpetuate failed solutions. We must understand that we must sacrifice for change. We must understand that our old ways, indifferent to science and consequence elsewhere, cannot endure. Last year, I devoted 33 editions of World Ocean Radio to a series called Rescue: How the Ocean Will Save Civilization, wherein I listed many different ways to respond through change across a full spectrum of behavior as a catalog of alternatives that we could explore and adopt to effect the change required. Change does not just happen. It lives in the intersection of ambition and action, be it political, technological, social, or cultural. For every effect, there is a cause, and more often than not these days, there is evidence in the ambitious impetus of the human hand as creator, benefactor, and eventually victim. Climate is ocean, ocean is climate. The sea connects all things. We must resort again to action, the application of a new ambition that will invent and embrace the cost, the sacrifice of change, to meet the new condition of the natural world we live in. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org, where the full catalog of more than 700 episodes of World Ocean Radio is searchable by theme. Thanks for listening.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Come join us at the station Friday, November 1st for KBOO's Dia de los Muertos